That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Now, you want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
We're after circulation. What we need is fireworks. People are going to hit with sledgehammers. Start arguments.
Oh, I can do that. I know this town inside out.
Did anybody ever say to you guys, you got 5 hours to get the story? Does that usually happen?
They usually give you less, so.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like an anachronism now. What? You got 5 hours to write a story?
Yeah, right. That's a lifetime in the news cycle now, right?
This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, contributor to Bloomberg View. Hey, Joni.
Good morning.
Knut Berger, Mossback at Crosscut.com, a columnist at Seattle Magazine. Hey, Knut.
Hey, Bill.
Hey, it's Bill. And Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Hey there, welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Welcome, everybody. This is where we talk about what the heck happened this week. And you remember last week we told you that Seattle City Light got outed for hiring an online reputation firm to plant puff pieces about the utility in order to bury the negative stories that were coming up when people Googled the name of City Light or its leader, Jorge Carrasco. As a result, you now see way more negative stories than you did before when you Googled the name of City Light or its leader, Jorge Carrasco. So this week, City Light said it would like a refund of its reputation management expenditure. Knut, can they also get their reputation back? Can they get a refund on that?
Well, you know, I don't know why they spent all that money, because somebody could have told him, look, just get on Facebook, post pictures of cats and recipes, and your clout score will be off the charts. He's done more damage trying to rehabilitate a negative reputation that no one knew he had,
right,
than if he had just left it alone.
And the timing was just so weird, because it was the exact week where the city council and the mayor were spending all this time, energy, and cash trying to decide if he should get a raise between like $60,000 and $120,000. And so all eyes on him, and he just couldn't win.
For the same amount of money that he spent on the reputation cleanup online, he could have hired a consultant who would have told him, hey, don't push for your raise a couple weeks after we just had this huge debate over whether or not some people in Seattle could earn $15 an hour.
Right. Do you think that it should be a ding on City Light, the hiring this reputation management firm?
Well, I think the worst part of it's not so much that he was trying to burnish the department's reputation, but it seems from the emails it was pretty clear it was mostly about him.
Yeah, I just want to say briefly that the Seattle Times printed a couple of these emails, and it has him emailing his chief of staff, this is a really nice piece, and on Huffington Post, no less. And then later he's Googling himself and seeing mean things, and yeah, it was a little embarrassing.
Well, yeah, and I think part of the problem is that the company that he hired used, you know, pretty unethical tactics in getting these articles placed. I mean, they essentially hired people to write articles. This one on Huffington Post is the example, paid this person to write a puff piece. The guy appeared to have interviewed him and didn't. Apparently, he just drafted a piece, said, hey, fill in the quotes, yep, that you want. Then it was published as a thing on Huffington Post without disclosing that he had any interest in what was going on. And it was clear that the City Light guys knew what was going on. I mean, and from a PR standpoint, you know, if you're going to write something, just do a press release. Of course, the reason they don't do that is they're not very effective.
Mm. And they have promised doctorate level content, and the content wasn't exactly doctorate level. It sounded kind of like it was written pretty breezy.
It's also embarrassing for Huffington Post that, yes, they allow themselves to be used in this way to launder people's reputations. I, for one, didn't know that Seattle City Light had a bad reputation. They were doing a pretty good job already of convincing me that they're the greenest utility in the nation, that they're offering all these incentives for people to improve their electricity consumption and efficiency and so on. And so they were improving something that was not a problem, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, apparently there was a Seattle Weekly article from 6 years ago or something that had some negative things to say, but no offense, Seattle Weekly, that is survivable for that to exist. By the way, you brought up that he's in the middle of his pay range has been increased. The mayor hasn't officially given him this pay increase. But in the Seattle Times story, the two stories they've done on this, at least, and then another I'll tell you about in a moment, They always mention this pay raise issue in there. Does it seem like the Seattle Times has it in for Carrasco, or sort of is enjoying reporting on this stuff at raise time?
Well, yes, and I think they're enjoying it, and I think they're doing a service. They're correcting his Google search results gaming. You know, he spent a lot of money, or the City Light spent a lot of money to game the system on Google so that when you search for him, you get puff pieces.
Do newspapers do that? Level the playing field like that?
And the Seattle Times, through good reporting, is pushing in the other direction.
Right. I mean, good reporters know where there's smoke, there's fire. And so they're going to dig in when they find something. It's given currency by the fact that this raise issue was out there. Now, the question is, how far will they push it? They've gone after his power usage records now, so we can see what his electricity bill is and whether or not he's living up to his own green standards, presumably. How far they go with that. I part of the problem is the people who run these utility companies, it's a really complicated job. It's really hard to hire good people. Mm-hmm. They hate the hiring process, kind of like we have a lot of those jobs in town. Police chief, school superintendent, and mm-hmm. head of City Light is one. So in one hand, you don't want to lose him, but you suspect that he was maybe concerned about his own reputation because maybe he's thinking about the next job or sort of moving on, because the obsession seems to come through pretty clearly that he was really worried. You know, as Eli pointed out, it's not like City Light had a bad reputation generally, but he seemed so focused on his own that you wonder if he was thinking about the resume.
I think the reporting is fair, because you have to realize when you have somebody who's about to become the highest paid city employee.
Except for Kathleen O'Toole now.
No, he will go higher.
Oh, that's right. He will go above her.
He will go
correct.
Higher.
Yes.
And this happened, if you'll recall, also, with the university president, University of Washington president, who was the highest paid state official. So people want to take a look. That makes sense. And the mayor spoke, don't forget, as if it was sort of a given that, you know, since he runs this green utility and other utility people in the same sort of kind of utility could make so much more, that we should all just say no questions asked. And so I appreciate the reporting for that reason. I want to know more about him because he's going to make so much darn money.
I want to know what you think of this other story that the Seattle Times kind of reprinted. There were a couple more details, but this is where, you know, a couple of guys showed up. This is last year. A couple of guys showed up at the City Light offices dressed in beads and fringes, said they were Cherokees from Oklahoma named Joe Wolf and Michael Little Bear, who teach disabled children how to make jewelry. Can we have some of your surplus copper wire? Carrasco happens to be waiting for his coffee at the lobby Starbucks. A City Light manager introduces the men to Carrasco. Thanks, manager, by the way. This is why I want to raise, because my managers make me deal with traveling jewelry teachers who are looking for bits of wire while I'm waiting for my coffee. Carrasco says, okay, fellas, I'll take your business cards. We would get those for you, but we've got a bus with 35 kids circling the block because they don't have a parking spot. Can we just have the copper? And the last guy who had your job gave us some copper. So, and here's some belt buckles and dream catchers. And so Carrasco calls his operations director, says, give these guys some copper, okay? My macchiato is cooling off rapidly. And after meeting with multiple managers, these guys drive off with 20 tons of copper wire and scrap metal worth $120,000. And it turns out they pull this scam all over the country. Do you think that story, in your mind, puts Jorge Carrasco in a negative light?
Yes.
Really?
Well, that's an easy question. Yeah.
Okay. Why?
Poor judgment. I mean, he got rolled too easily, right? Someone who's running an organization or a department of city government that's as complex and important as Seattle City Light should have a little bit of skepticism about things like that, and also very good judgment. And this is obviously an example of poor judgment. I think he would have admitted to that. This also was several years ago, so presumably he wouldn't do the same thing again. Presumably this is something that maybe improved his judgment. And so that your question about whether it's fair to dredge it up now, it is fair. He's opened the door with all of the stuff that's gone on with the Huffington Post and with his raise issue, but it is worth remembering this was a while ago.
And that it had already been reported in the Seattle PI back in December. That was a key part of sort of the chronology of the story.
Yeah, I didn't think it reflected too poorly on him. I thought the con artist had one of the most credible statements where they said the kids are circling the block, can't find parking.
Sounds about right.
That's Seattle.
They did their research.
Of course, there's no parking.
This is KUOW's Week in Review, and we'll move on here. I want to hear your thoughts. You, as in the listener, you know, we're online, KUOW Public Radio on Facebook, at KUOW on Twitter. We'll even take your phone calls. What is that number? 685-2526. We need an acronym for that. What is 2526? It's like B-L, I think it's BLAM. I think it's 685-BLAM. So we'll read some of your notes or play your phone calls maybe at the end of the show. We'll be right back with KUOW's Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review with Eli Sanders, Associate Editor at The Stranger, Knute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com, and a columnist at Seattle Magazine. Joni Balter is host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel and a contributor to Bloomberg View. And I'm Bill Radke, and this is where we once a week, you know, digest, dish, talk about what was important that happened this week. This week, Seattle's new police chief, Kathleen O'Toole, was confirmed with the vote of every single Seattle City Council member except Shama Sawant. She voted no because O'Toole said she will run the department like an efficient business, and Sawant said that businesses are not accountable to the people. Knute, did you understand that criticism?
Well, I think she'll leave the running of the city as a non-efficient business to the mayor.
Wow.
Well, what I mean by that is governing isn't a business. Public it's often called on in the service of business. The mayor this week, you know, announced a summer of safety, this new kind of overarching strategy for dealing with public safety. And you know, he used words like moral failure and epidemic in describing. Well, those are things businesses don't necessarily have to deal with as business. Mm. They are things that are public health issues and issues that have to do with social justice. And the mayor is kind of saying, you know, the Kathleen O'Toole has to run the department. She has to do it the way I want her to do it. She has to do it the way the feds want her to do it. But it's part of a piece of a package I'm responsible for that's a lot bigger than that.
So Shama Sawant's criticism, was that meaningful to you to say, no, we don't run our government like a business?
Well, I think that's credible as a general rule that it is not business. But I think that the issue isn't running it as a business. The business is running it in a professional business-like manner. Hmm. And I think that's a different.
Perhaps that word business is what threw her. And also, you know, Councilmember Sawant sometimes just likes to make a point. And it's okay when you're doing a confirmation to have something that's 8-1.
8-1 instead of 9-0.
Yeah. And I mean, the only thing I hope is that it doesn't like make the relationship between the council member and the police chief troubled. But at least it puts Kathleen O'Toole that, you know, everybody loves you, but you have some work to do over here.
We're watching
with this person here.
Mm-hmm. I also hope it doesn't become too much of a pattern of inflexibility for Sawant. She did a great job during the minimum wage debate of proving people wrong when they said she was just a rigid ideologue. And she actually really threaded the needle on a lot of issues and compromised and was pragmatic. And now she made this comment and voted no against O'Toole. It's worth saying that her comment about not running the police department like a business came in the context of a 10-minute long speech that she gave about why she wasn't voting for O'Toole. And that speech, when you listen to the whole thing, is a little hard to figure out what exactly her point is. She throws a lot of things out there, but a lot of them are not really specific criticisms of O'Toole. And so it begins to seem like just an excuse to maybe grandstand a little bit. But if she's definitely concerned about O'Toole's comments about running the department like a business, fine. Let's see, though, in the future whether she continues to be this one lone vote on things where maybe her criticism is not entirely on point. It's also worth noting that she voted against Sawant's salary saying, or I'm sorry, against O'Toole. Sawant voted against O'Toole's salary, saying it was too high. She doesn't support salaries that high for public officials. Another thing that came up in the context of Sawant's criticism of O'Toole is, wait a minute, this is the first female police chief in Seattle. We talk a lot about gender pay equity. We've got the Carrasco issue going on. Are you actually on the wrong side of this here? Should we be saying, well, the police chief should be paid as much as, say, the head of Seattle City Light?
Interesting. You know, Knut brought up Mayor Murray's presentation this week about public safety. I want to ask you all about that, because he said a lot of things that it seems hard to disagree with, which always puzzles me a little. For example, the mayor said, we have not over the years developed a coherent and coordinated citywide approach to public safety policy. Really? Why not?
They keep trying, is what they keep trying. But, you know, every mayor, especially this mayor who came in and said that public safety and the police chief and the whole bit was his number one topic. So 6 months in, after, and he is at the 6 month mark here, after doing quite a few things on all different kind of topics, Lyft and police chiefs and minimum wage, he's saying he wants to be more cohesive in general on police, but he wanted to hurry up and do it before the summer began, because we have a lot of trouble here in the public safety realm in the summer. So,
did he say anything specific that gives you some idea of what he means by that he's going to be that mayor?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, to Joni's point, he's talking about increasing outreach between the department and the East African community in the South End. And let's, I mean, the South End is really where a lot of the action is, and that's unfortunate. You know, the gun-related major crimes in the South End are about four or five times more than they are in the North Precinct. So he's identifying very specific area and going after it in specific ways, extending community center hours. He wants to increase summer jobs for kids. He wants to specifically have a program of women police officers pairing up with women in the Somali community. You know, there are a lot of specifics that sort of go along with this. And then he's got the big issues, which is he's pushing for background checks for all gun sales. That's of course going to be an initiative and a big issue in the fall. He also is advocating a police accountability system that's truly independent. This is something that some people have wanted ever since we had.
Why isn't it independent now?
Well, because it's not independent in most cities. It's because the police don't want it to be independent.
And
it's also sometimes has to do with budget issues. But there are cities that do it that way. Minneapolis is one. I think it's important that he stated he wanted to go in that direction.
Police lost a little power this week when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that police cannot search your smartphone without a warrant.
The cops were not happy with this ruling. Yost Zachary is the chief of police in Woodway, Texas.
It will slow down some of law enforcement's work. It could adversely affect our ability to investigate and combat some crime.
That's NPR's Martin Costi. Costi says there's still stuff we don't know about this ruling, like when you do search a smartphone, what counts as plain view?
When police search a house, they're allowed to collect unexpected evidence if they see that evidence in, quote, plain view. But what happens when they get a warrant to search a smartphone? What's plain view? Can they open every calendar item, every photo?
Eli, do you feel more safe or less safe after the Supreme Court ruling?
More. I like that the Supreme Court is protecting our privacy on our cell phones. And this was a unanimous ruling for the Supreme Court. They are obviously signaling that there's a problem here and that we need to catch up with technology in terms of what's allowed for warrants. So all in all, I feel safer, and it gives me a little more faith than I've had in the Supreme Court overall.
Linda Greenhouse, writing in the New York Times, and she's covered the Supreme Court for a very long time, had a very astute observation. She said it turns out, you know, she had been wondering about how they'd rule on a case like this. It turns out all nine justices have cell phones, and so they know exactly what's in there. They get it, that it's, they use the language that it's sometimes more private, more personal than a house because of all that you put in there. It helps that they have phones.
I'm glad I have a dumb phone. There's nothing in there of any interest to anybody, even me.
KOW's Week in Review. Knut Berger there, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders. I'm Bill Radke, and we'd like to hear from you on Facebook, KOW Public Radio, on the Twitter, at KOW. What do we decide? 685, our phone number is 685-2526. So play along, come along, and let us know what you noticed about this week's news. This is KUOW's Week in Review. You're listening to KOW's Week in Review with Joni Balter of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, contributor to Bloomberg View, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, Knut Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com, and a Seattle Magazine columnist. And I'm Bill Radke, and we're running through the big stories this week. Soccer is a sport where you can lose the game and still advance in the playoffs. And that happened yesterday to the U.S. men's soccer team in a match watched by so many, many fans across the Puget Sound region. We love soccer here. The Seattle Sounders are the most profitable team in Major League Soccer, drawing by far the biggest crowds in the league. And why? Well, maybe because we appreciate the way the game's pure athleticism and grace have a way of bringing this world together.
Displays of neo-Nazi banners.
Star striker Luis Suarez appeared to bite his opponent.
Homophobic chants by their fans during their game last week.
Fans raise their pitch, and just before the point of contact, they take a big collective breath and scream the Spanish word for male prostitute or whore.
We are the world. The beauty of sport. I don't know. Why do you think Seattle loves soccer?
I think it's sort of some of the very many young folks that live here and come from all over the country and all over the world, if you think about it, because soccer is from all over the world.
But all cities have immigrants. I mean, what is there something
well,
about
the,
Seattle?
The second most soccer-oriented city is Washington, D.C., which also has people there from all over the world, and a lot of young folks working there, too. You said something fairly funny about, you know, how you lose and still advance. So yep. The New York Times yesterday had this funny chart, 984 ways for the U.S. to advance, even if it loses in the one quadrant there. It's hilarious how that works. But our hopes are alive. We're still going.
Yes. Just in case you don't know, USA, first of all, there was a conspiracy theory, because if the USA and Germany had tied, they both would have gone on together, and then all would have been forgiven with Germany. It didn't happen. The U.S. Lost, but still went ahead, and that's football.
And if you watch the game, neither team was interested in a tie. Yeah. This was a brutal game, especially at the end. One reason I think Seattle is so into the World Cup this year and the American team is that we've got two Sounders on it.
Yep.
Yedlin was coming in late in the game. Yes, was it yesterday that this game was played?
Yes. Hmm.
The week went by in a blur. Yedlin is made a habit of coming in late in the game and being key in helping the U.S. either score or make some tough attempts on goals. And where I was watching when Yedlin came in, it was just a huge roar in the bar. Everyone really excited, everyone watching him. Also,
great player with great hair.
Yeah, and speed. Yeah. He is so fast. And I'm forgetting the name of the forward.
Clint Dempsey, the captain.
Dempsey, right, who was on the cover of, I think, Outside Magazine this month or week. You know, as a kind of sex symbol and soccer god. So there's a lot of interest in the World Cup that connects directly to the Sounders. And then in terms of the sort of social gravitational pull towards soccer in Seattle, it's strong in Europe. We're basically a province of Europe at this point, politically and socially and culturally here. And then also, I think you could maybe trace it back to our investments in parks and fields. We have, more than a lot of other cities, opportunities to get out there and play soccer. And because of that, there's very strong club system in the city for people growing up, never mind soccer being played at high schools.
Do we love soccer despite the weather here? Because of the weather? It never stops you from playing soccer. It's always mild. But
well,
it's
you
always
saw that
kinda
game yesterday. It was all pure rain.
Yeah.
Pure rain.
Yep, pure rain.
Well,
what do you think?
I think I'm converting to a soccer fan only because Ann Coulter hates it so much. You know? And I figure,
why does she hate it?
She thinks it is that the popularity of soccer is indicative of America's moral decay. She gave now. So it's not Wall Street. It's not the over-commercialization of everything. It's not godlessness. It's soccer, apparently, that's the sign of moral decay. Well, she thinks we're being Europeanized, and this idea that there are no winners.
Well, that's what Eli said. We're European.
Right, that there's it's the idea that you could go on to triumph with a nil-nil tie, you know,
or even a loss.
Americans like simple solutions.
Right.
Like the touchdown, or buy it now, or hang them. You know, we like things that are more definitive and less open to kind of negotiation.
We're a polite city, and there's nothing more polite than advancing in the playoffs and yet still letting your opponent win.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have the feeling that consensus is involved at some point in this tournament. You know,
right.
They have to sit down. But anyway, I just think the culture thing, that the idea that soccer's un-American is so absurd. In terms of what that means, that I'm going to have to start paying attention. Apparently,
I didn't get to hear what she thought of the bite that went around the world.
That was very American.
Exactly. This is a Uruguayan player who bit his opponent, and not for the first time. He's
Mike
a biter.
Tyson did
like many little children. He's a biter.
Right. Mike Tyson did it first.
Mike Tyson did it first.
Yeah, made that's right. But the more biting, the more broken noses, and all that kind of stuff, the more Americans, you'll eventually breach the sort of yuppie popularity wall and get into middle America.
I want to ask about yuppies. I wonder, do you think that there is an element of in Seattle that we like soccer in part because it makes us feel multicultural and a little more worldly than the football and, you know, et cetera fans?
I think there's an element of that. I also think that it connects to some of the, you know, if we want to get really philosophical about this, it connects to some of the qualities that we mock Seattle for having and loving and embracing too hard. You brought up process. The game itself is all about process and many people involved in that process. You can't play soccer without the 11 players on the field. It starts to fall apart when you lose one of them, which sometimes you do because of a penalty. But you need lots of people involved in moving one thing forward slowly, and it goes backward and then forward and then to the side.
I'm waiting for Ed Murray to say soccer is like gay marriage.
Or like the minimum wage process.
You have to wait 18 years.
There's also less of an emphasis on stars, on single players who define the game. There are stars in soccer, but they are not as bright as in other sports. In other words, there's much more of an emphasis on teamwork, which again is something that Seattle likes to say that it's more invested in. So I think dispositionally there's an attachment.
You know, I went to a Sounders game with the old Sounders, like in the 1970s at Memorial Stadium. It was raining, it was grim, and there were, I don't know, 80 people in the stands. You know,
Pele wasn't there, I take it?
Yeah, no. It was a totally different thing, and the sort of the epitome of the old Simpsons view of, you know, how boring soccer is.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of it has to be, I think, the fan experience. I have many friends who are not like soccer maniacs who've been down to the stadium to games and come back and just say the atmosphere is amazing. They love it. And I think that's part of it, too.
Are we taking on any more of the negative? You know, I played the tape up at the top about, you know, soccer might seem far away. It can be a little bit sanitized, I think. Like, I think the Irish pubs in Seattle are a little bit of a happier place than the actual pubs in Ireland. You know what I mean? Soccer, as it's actually experienced around the world, is a pretty grubby, you know, violent, homophobic, et cetera, neo-Nazi thing. Are we get rude? A rude thing? Is soccer getting rude? Do we haze the Portland Timber fans? I'm like, are we taking on that stuff?
I was just going to talk about the Timber Sounders game that I went to. So the Sounders, like a lot of clubs in Europe, have their supporters who march into the stadium en masse and have been partying for an hour or so beforehand and have a band with them and are really, really invested in the team and pretty aggressive also. And so in that sense, we are becoming more like other soccer clubs and fan groups around the world. And there was tension with the Timbers and their supporters who also showed up en masse but were kept in a separate space in the stadium, and then they were made to exit separately. But it wasn't like you were going to see the soccer brawls that you get in Europe, like are described in the Bill Buford book, Among the Thugs, which is a great look at the dark side of soccer that you're talking about. We don't get anywhere near that, but we do have a lot of the trappings of the fan groups and the kind of army of supporters who march in.
And this World Cup is sort of setting some records for all around the country, not just Seattle, for people watching and being involved. I caught Ross Reynolds' report yesterday on the record from Germany, and he was talking about how incredible in Europe, you know, like they have TV screens through the city squares. We're not quite there yet, but we're on our way.
KUOW's Week in Review is on our way, back in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review is Bill Radke, and this week, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, and Knute Berger. Some SeaTac airport workers will apparently get a raise, but not others. SeaTac voters, of course, approved that $15 an hour minimum wage, but a court then ruled that the Port of Seattle has jurisdiction over airport workers. This week, the Port Commission said, okay, we'll raise the wage for cargo and baggage handlers and wheelchair attendants, cleaners, maintenance workers, but if you work at Dish Delish, or Anthony's or Ivor's at the airport or other restaurant retail spots, the port says it'll take another look at your wages when it's contract time. The pro $15 an hour crowd says that's not enough. Eli, is it enough?
Well, it's not what they were hoping that they would get when SeaTac had this vote. The intent of the vote was to help the airport workers benefit from the raised $15 an hour. And like you said, it turned out to not be possible to do it that way. So it's not enough. It's not what workers in Seattle are being paid. It's not what workers in the rest of SeaTac are being paid. And I think Christine Gregoire's daughter, whose first name I'm going to... Courtney Gregoire, who's on the Port Commission, pointed out that this is not just an economic justice issue. This is a security issue. You want workers at the airport to be happy, to not have high turnover in those jobs because they're paid so poorly. And so giving them a raise makes sense from that perspective as well.
Worker retention is so important here. And you know, in all of the debate about the minimum wage, you know, they always say, well, you know, if you raise the minimum wage too high, you're going to force people, you're going to ruin the businesses and everything's going to go bad. But actually, the studies have shown that what you do is you stop the turnover. You have great worker retention. You have people wanting to work in these jobs. And that actually saves money. It's not just like, doesn't that feel good? It actually is good for various operations like the port. And that's what Courtney Gregoire was saying.
I mentioned restaurant workers. How does Alaska Airlines fit into this right now? Does anyone understand? It gets awfully complicated.
Well, Alaska Airlines doesn't, I don't think, employ any restaurant workers at the port,
right,
or the people who we're talking about in terms of baggage handlers or maintenance workers or the people who pick up, say, a disabled person who's in a wheelchair. I think what they're doing with their flight attendants and pilots is their own thing, and I'm sure those people are being paid way more than $15 an hour anyway.
Washington State Supreme Court heard arguments on the question this week. What do you know what the court is considering, the state Supreme Court, in this issue?
Well, aren't they trying to decide whether or not the initiative would actually apply to the airport workers? Because that was the big dispute at the lower court, whether or not that initiative that passed, does it apply to? Hmm. The initial ruling was that it doesn't apply to airport workers. Only the port can make that kind of a decision. And then the port seemed to be playing hurry up here to try to catch up to some of this trend.
Yeah. And obviously there are companies that have restaurants, you know, at the port that are, it's a contract that's been negotiated, the business model and whatnot was decided on a certain kind of level of pay. And so the issue is, can you have those increases happen during a contract, or do you wait until those contracts are renegotiated when they're up? I think that's part of the issue, too, in terms of the timing of when this could happen. The port could make that a requirement of contractors when those contracts, you know, are up.
When the SeaTac vote was happening, one of the arguments from businesses who had franchises at the airport was that, whoa, we're going to have to pay $15 to the Ivers at the airport employees, but not the ones in Seattle. So for some businesses like, say, Ivers, which I think did make this argument then, they have less ground to stand on now because they're paying their employees in Seattle now more than their employees at the airport. The other interesting wrinkle is that the strategic reason, I think, for running this in SeaTac to begin with was that you had this mass of workers at the airport who were arguably very underpaid and would support this initiative and did. And they voted for their economic interests, but then legally weren't able to see the fruits of that.
And also many other airports around the country have done the big salary increase. So airports are actually like this little separate category where raises have gone into effect in different places in the country.
Thoughts on the minimum wage? I don't think I remember to ask you why Seattle loves soccer. I'd love to hear your opinion about that, too, at area code 206-685-2526. Tweet us at KUOW. Our Facebook page is KUOW Public Radio. KUOW's Week in Review is back momentarily. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information and the Reviewing of the Week, which happens right now every Friday. I'm Bill Radke with Eli Sanders from The Stranger, Canute Berger, Crosscut and Seattle Magazine, Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail, and Bloomberg View. And that's who they are. And we are running down the top stories of the week. This week, the Washington State Liquor Control Board filed emergency rules for recreational marijuana. What's the emergency? The state wants to stop the packaging of edible marijuana products until it's satisfied that the packages carry chemical information and a warning and don't appeal to children. There will be no public hearings on this matter because it's an emergency. Joni, we legalized pot, almost 2 years ago?
Yes, indeed.
Why is this an emergency?
I love any sentence that has pot and emergency, you know, in the same single sentence. The emergency is that the stores are finally opening.
July 8th?
July 8th, maybe something like 20 stores will open. And so what has happened is there was a lot of attention from the Liquor Control Board to the pot part of this discussion. And there was some attention paid to the edibles. But the edibles have been having a rough PR kind of couple weeks in Colorado especially and also here because, you know, so the question is, 10 milligrams of THC is a single serving, and a single package can only have 100 milligrams. That's 10 servings. So I don't know about you, but if you see a candy bar, you don't think of it as like that's 10
servings. 10 servings.
You see candy bar, you eat candy bar, and off you go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not so good. So the emergency is to get some decent sort of rules around the packaging, the labeling, the actual products. And so you're going to hear two words that are going to sound funny, and you and I have talked about this before, scoring. So scoring is to take that candy bar and mark exactly, more like a Kit Kat, you know, because you can really tell what piece is what piece. So to mark on that candy bar what is a single serving, because a lot of people, the problem with edible pot is a lot of people will take a bite and say, I didn't feel anything. And then they'll come back and, you know, try another bite. But it can take 30 minutes to 2 hours for this to take effect. And by the time you're on the two-hour mark, as Maureen Dowd, the columnist for the New York Times, found, she was like in a fetal position and couldn't really move. The other word is homogenizing the pot. So if you take, like, this candy bar, you can't have all the pot in two or three servings. You need to make sure that it actually spread out within it. So in Colorado, they tell the story of a truffle that has 65 milligrams of THC. Uh-oh, where's the THC? You're going to eat the whole truffle or half, or are you just going to guess? So this is where some of these new rules have to come.
I'm imagining Mrs. C's type, you know, like, oh, that swirl means this is the extra THC, you know.
And there may, in fact, be hearings. The governor's office wasn't completely sure. They were trying to answer me right before the show started. What they do with emergency rules is they put them in effect because, you know, these stores are going to open, and they want to make sure that if anybody is going to be selling edibles that they understand the rules. They don't want packaging that kind of attracts children. You have to be very careful. The new packages have to say this is a marijuana product. And that little candy bar I showed you, you know, they have to say how many milligrams of THC is in here so people can proceed intelligently.
you were asking why it's an emergency, and it's something that Joni referred to. I think it's an emergency from a PR perspective because Maureen Dowd flew to Colorado and got a candy bar and had a bad trip and wrote something very compelling about it.
Really? You think that's a big part of this, huh?
That is when the attention to this began. It was kind of churning in Colorado, but from a national perspective, people hadn't clued into this problem until Maureen Dowd experienced it and everyone on social media started talking about it, started talking about whether that was a fair experiment that she ran.
Yeah, because she really broke through with something that arguably was pretty embarrassing to her, that she acted pretty foolishly, didn't she? She's by herself experimenting, you know, alone with some drug, and she, you know,
well, especially
just how it works.
Since what I read in the Denver Post.
If it was all true.
That she went on a 45-minute tour of a processing place, and they talk about scoring and different serving sizes, and she sort of didn't end up taking that into account. But I would argue that the high-profile thing happened because of some things that have happened in Colorado. And, you know, they're ahead of us. They opened their stores in January, and they've had two deaths linked to edibles. And they've had an increase in the number of children in emergency rooms. So, in other words, children running into packages that look kind of attractive. I mean, there are even marijuana gummy bears that maybe probably isn't the best idea, because that says kid to me anyway.
Oh. Well, the American consumer loves kid-like products or products that are sold as kid-like. I remember talking with an advertising guy at J. Walter Thompson years ago, and they had trouble with Lemon Pledge because they did these commercials that talked about how lemony it was. People started drinking it. So it doesn't take much. And you see alcohol sold in bright colors, you know, so it looks like soda pop, you see. You know, good luck trying to eliminate the kid appeal from the packaging.
How do you make a candy unappealing to a kid?
Well, exactly. The other thing is that when you combine, Starbucks has built an entire franchise learning that if you combine two drugs, you know, like caffeine and sugar, not only can you get $4 for a cup of coffee, but people will come back.
Right.
You know, and so, pitching these edibles as candy and the portion idea. Have you ever opened like a thing of almonds and it says, you know, one serving is three almonds?
Half an almond.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
How many people eat three salted almonds? Marijuana high can give you the munchies. Even if you were wise to begin with, once you're into it, you know, that candy bar is going to look kind of tempting.
By the way, these grand openings in early July, there might be some empty shelves. Correspondent Anna King told us this week about a possible pot shortage, and she took us to one of the biggest pot farms in the state, Monkey Grass Farms in eastern Washington.
This place looks like the inside of Costco, just it's filled with a whole lot of pot. But if you think you're going to see any of this choice bud in stores at the beginning of July, you're smoking.
By the way, we in the media really have changed our tone about marijuana. It's like because it's now legally okay, it's also tasteful to talk about it, to say choice bud. I guess the stranger's probably been very consistent over the years.
We were ahead of that.
Yes.
The media has an inherent bias toward things that are legal and against things that are illegal, except alternative media and the stranger in particular. I think we have more of we're less swayed by that division. We have a lot of interest in things that are not legal.
Right. Anyway, apparently these growers haven't been given time to get their stuff to market. And edibles won't likely be on store shelves at first because they take even more time and they haven't licensed any kitchens.
They actually haven't licensed any kitchens. You know, they just were putting this out in case, you know, there was a crunch point. And the kitchens will have to be licensed and they will have to look at the packaging, the products, the whole bit. But they haven't done that yet. But it's a coming.
It's KUOW's Week in Review.
He just wishes he could get his product into consumers' hands a bit quicker. He's hoping the pot biz chills out by October.
We'll be right back. We have confirmed that our phone number is 206-685-BLAM. That was pretty good off the cuff. It's 685-2526. We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at KUOW. Our Facebook page is KUOW Public Radio. We are running down the hits, the big stories this week, and By the way, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, Joni Balter, and I'm Bill Radke. This week, it's time to look into your domestic partner's eyes and tell them you love them, because your partnership will self-destruct in 3 days. Since Washington state voters legalized same-sex marriage, same-sex domestic partnerships will automatically be converted to marriage as of the end of this month, which is Monday. Are we assuming, Eli, that all domestic partners want to be married?
No. And in fact, there's a provision for domestic partners who are over 62. This gets very complicated very fast. So let me back up a little bit. When we were having the whole debate about marriage equality, whether Washington state would recognize gay marriage, part of the argument for recognizing same-sex marriage was that we had this second-class citizenship, essentially, for gay couples. We called it domestic partnership. And over the years, it had come to have almost all of the rights of marriage, except it couldn't be called marriage. And so, A, why do you have the second-class citizenship? B, what's the problem if, in terms of rights and responsibilities, it's almost the same but for that word marriage? So if you're making that argument, the logical conclusion is that at the end of all this, when you win and declare victory, domestic partnership has to go away, which it is now doing. Except there are a lot of people who said, wait a minute, there are elderly Washingtonians who are in heterosexual couples and same-sex couples who have been married, don't want to be married again, lose a spouse, and get into partnerships that are really what domestic partnerships classically should be, or what you would think of if you just came up with a commonsensical definition of a domestic partnership.
Well, I don't understand. Why is being a domestic partner better when you're older than being married?
Because you want to provide, in my understanding, you want to provide a right for, say, your elderly aunt who loses her husband and the older gentleman that she meets and starts to cohabitate with, and they don't want to get remarried because they feel like they lived a life with their husband or wife, and it's not something that they want to do, have another marriage. They're still connected to the person who passed on.
Okay.
But they do want to live with someone, and they do have a relationship, and they're in what is really a domestic partnership. And so how politically, if you're trying to get marriage equality passed, how do you bring that group of people on board to vote for marriage equality? You carve out an exception, which is what happened. And so if you are in a domestic partnership in Washington state right now where one person is over the age of 62 and presumably in that situation that I'm describing, your domestic partnership stays. It will still exist. And if you age into that category and want to have a domestic partner at some point in your life, you still can. But if you are 32 and in a domestic partnership with someone else who is under 62, your domestic partnership, as you were putting it, implodes, but you're automatically enrolled in a marriage against your will, whether you want to or not.
But you can opt out, right?
You can, but you have to get involved. If you're just sitting back and doing nothing and domestic partnered and under 62, like I said, this gets complicated fast, but if that's your situation, you're married on Monday.
Got it.
Well, I understand some of the older domestic partners also don't want to jeopardize things like pension benefits or whatever they might be getting as a result of not remarrying. And so that might be another incentive. The thing is that if you don't do anything, which a lot of people don't, and you end up finding yourself married to someone that you didn't really intend to marry, getting unmarried is not that easy.
Is it any different to get unmarried compared to undomestic partnered? Like, is divorce harder, you know, from a marital partner than
That's actually a great question. But I can tell you there are all kinds of, in divorce in the state, there's all kinds of paperwork. There's all kinds of waiting periods. You have to go to court. I mean, it's an elaborate process. It's not a, you know, wham bam kind of thing. But I don't know the answer.
What if you broke up with your partner but never got around to formalizing it? And now you're automatically married if you don't opt out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why you have to be paying attention and get involved. That
awkward.
Listen
will
to
happen
the
on
news.
Monday. That's someone's situation.
Pay attention.
This is what KUOW is for.
Ooh.
Saving you from an accidental marriage to your ex boyfriend.
Right. And then there's just the whole kind of dispositional opposition to marriage. You know, like, marriage sounds so. You know, it has connotation. You may not be religious, which it has, you know, religious overtones. You may not like the, you know, the old kind of patriarchal ways that, you know, it has baggage, but is that, maybe that's not a big, we can just redefine what marriage is and that's leave that behind.
Well, we went around this issue many, many times during the marriage equality debate in Washington State. And one of the things that's very hard to get people to see, because you're right, marriage is associated in people's minds with religion. But what is actually the case and what is hard to get people to see is that we are talking here only about civil marriage. The marriage law that passed in Washington State has nothing to do with any religious group or church or what they have to do or not don't have to do. This is just about civil marriage equality. And so you can actually come at Washington's definition from a non-religious perspective.
30 seconds, Joni.
Well, these two initiatives, gay marriage and recreational marijuana, were both passed in November of 2012. So it's interesting to me that at this point, we're just sort of spinning out some of the ramifications. They're coming true and they're coming real to us at this time.
Coming real to you. This is KUOW's Week in Review with Joni Balter and Eli Sanders, Knute Berger. I'm Bill Radke. Back in a sec. Joni Balter hosts Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, contributes to Bloomberg View, Eli Sanders, associate edits The Stranger, and Knute Berger, Mossbacks at Crosscut.com. He's a columnist at Seattle Magazine. From you, Brain Zapper tweeted at us about soccer. Seattle is so into soccer because of all the hipsters. Give me baseball any day. Go Mariners. We got this email from Steven. Soccer will get more popular when people finally get how dangerous it is. Hitting the ball without head protection leads to the most concussions in any sport. Did he say soccer will get more popular when people get that? Oh, when we start to protect ourselves. Oh, no, helmets? Did he see saying helmets are coming to soccer? Oh, Stephen. And Ashley wrote with some help on our phone number, which I said 206-685-2526. I said, what did I say, blam? Ashley says it also spells 685-clam and 685-a-jam. Thank you, Ashley. Whatever helps you remember us, put it in your phone and pocket dial us anytime through the week. 30 seconds, any final remarks on the week that just went by?
Well, in terms of soccer and head protection, if you watched yesterday's game, one of the other dangers is colliding heads. That happened on the American team. Two players ran into each other and knocked heads. You see that actually happen pretty frequently. But if we get to a point where there's a debate about helmets in soccer, there's going to be huge resistance to that idea.
Be careful out there. Knute, Eli, Joni, thank you. I'm Bill Radke, KUOW 94.9, Seattle News and the Information.